Disciples is that if we loved each other. So when you find true followers of Jesus, you'll find that they are very open to inviting you into their lives. You might have to make an effort too, but when you do, you'll discover the wonderful gift of God's family.
Another one of the 12 gifts of Christmas from your station for Christmas.
Thanks for listening to AM 740, K-Bright.
The views and opinions expressed on the following program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of Crawford Broadcasting Company, this station, or its sponsors.
Good morning and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg and we're live for a half hour each weekday morning, and we take your phone calls during that half hour. If you have questions about the Bible or about the Christian faith and want to ask them for discussion here, or if you have a difference of opinion from the host and want to bring that up for discussion here, either one is quite all right. The main thing is we have limits on our time, and that only means you should call early. If you call early, we'll almost certainly get to your call. If you wait and call later in the program, well, we might not. So I would encourage you, if you want to get on the show, just give me a call. The number is 1-800-227-5278. That's 800-227-5278. I have a couple of announcements to make, and then we'll get right to our callers. One of these announcements is for people in the Temecula area, and the other is for people in Orange County. The Temecula area announcement has to do with every Thursday morning, with the exception of holidays. We canceled this on Thanksgiving. We'll not be doing it on Christmas morning or New Year's Day either. But apart from really unusual situations like that, we have a weekly Bible study in Temecula on Thursday mornings early. So if you're an early morning person and live nearby, you can join us. We're studying through the book of Proverbs. And I'm teaching that, and we have about an hour, usually, from 6:30 to 7:30, and it's held at the Panera Bread restaurant. That's right across the street, pretty much from Costco in Temecula, the Panera Bread place. We meet there at 6:30 to study Proverbs on Thursday mornings. You're welcome to that. It's an open gathering, and we have met many of our listeners there that we're very pleased to get to know. And we'd like to get to know you, too, if you happen to be in the area. The other announcement is that this Saturday, I'll be speaking again on, this time on the second part of the Strategies for Unity series in Buena Park, California. So those in Orange County, take heed, Saturday night in Buena Park. I think last month when we did this, it was on a Friday, if I'm not mistaken. Saturday may be more convenient for many of you, although we had a good crowd there on the Friday last time. We do this only once a month. And so if you want to know where that's located, I can tell you right now, but you can also find it at our website, thenarrowpath.com. Now, at thenarrowpath.com, you'll go to the link that says Announcements, and there you'll find the location and time of my speaking engagements. In Buena Park this Saturday night, it'll be at 6 p.m., and it's at the Way Fellowship. It's a Baptist church, but it's called the Way Fellowship, and it's at 7142 Thomas Street in Buena Park. That's this Saturday at 6 p.m., and we'd be glad to see any of you who may want to join us there. Our first caller today is Chuck, calling from Santa Ana, California. Chuck, welcome to the Narrow Path.
Hi.
Thanks for calling.
How are you doing? Hi. Thanks for taking the call.
Good.
I have a question on an author that authored an article on the age of the Earth and why the Earth is not millions of years old. His name is David. Can I mention the name?
Sure.
Okay, David Icke, I-C-K-E-S. He's an English professor, and he has a real long, in-depth article on why the Earth is not millions of years old. I don't know if you ever heard of him. That's my
I don't know if I've heard of him, but I've certainly read authors who have the same thesis.
Yeah. He's got some.
What would you say is his most persuasive point?
Well, he's very in depth. He's very scientific about things, about this solar system, the universe, and so many things that have to do with scientific stuff. Almost leans toward the Bible and a lot of things. But I just wondered if you ever
heard of him. Is this a Christian author or secular?
It doesn't say here. It doesn't say he's a believer at all.
Mm-hmm.
But
that's interesting.
I could forward you the link. Do you have a site where I can email or something?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, you can email
it
to me.
I can find it on your
website. It's real simple. It's real simple. It's steve@thenarrowpath.com.
What is it?
steve@thenarrowpath.com.
Okay, great. All right, good enough. Thank you very much. Thanks.
All right, Chuck, thanks for the heads up. Send it to me. Bye now. Okay, our next caller is Letty from Rialto, California. Welcome to The Narrow Path, and thanks for calling.
Thank you.
Hello.
Hello?
Yes.
I have a question. Is a relationship that started out as adultery, can that ever be legitimized in the eyes of God?
Well, David's relationship with Bathsheba started out with adultery, and eventually it was legitimized in the sight of God. But there would be... It would not always be possible to do so. I mean, let's say that a man had an affair against his faithful wife, and he wanted to be married to his lover. Well, I don't think he could do that, not as long as his faithful wife was desiring his return. Now, on the other hand, his adultery gives, I think, his faithful wife grounds for divorce. If she takes those grounds, if she divorces him and moves on with her life, then she doesn't want him back. She's renounced the marriage, too, and she has legitimately done so because of his adultery. Then I would think there would be the possibility of the relationship that started out bad being sanctified if it were marked with true repentance. And, I'm thinking of David's case. Certainly, we have to say that eventually God saw the marriage between David and Bathsheba as something that he legitimized because Jesus came through that marriage, for one thing. And God selected Solomon, Bathsheba's son, from all David's sons to be the next king. Certainly it gives the impression that God had, redeemed that bad situation. But it could never have been redeemed if Bathsheba's husband, Uriah, was still living and still wanting his wife back. If he wanted his wife back, David would have had to send her back, of course. And he couldn't marry her because she belonged to a living man. But if in this particular case, her husband was dead, if, on the other hand, her husband had divorced her and let her go, then according to the law of Moses, she could marry David. So a relationship that begins in adultery could possibly, in some cases, end up being a legitimate marriage. But it would be only under certain special circumstances in which there was no cheated party who is still looking for redress. You see, the great crime in adultery, I believe, is that it wrongs somebody. It violates somebody's rights. It violates the rights of the husband whose wife cheats or the rights of the wife whose husband cheats. And those rights need to be redressed unless that person gives up their rights and says, okay, I'm done with you. I divorce you because of your adultery. Well, if that's the case, then they're relinquishing their rights to be to have their spouse come back. They don't want them back, and that's their right because of the adultery. So there are circumstances where that would be possible. If you'd like to have a thorough biblical treatment of all the matters related to divorce and remarriage, I've written an article on that. Actually, it was three articles that were published in magazines years ago, and it's now one combined article at my website, simply called Divorce and Remarriage. If you're interested in reading, it deals with all the relevant scriptures on the subject and gives most of the practical scenarios that people would face and applies the scriptures to them. if that's interesting to you, you can go to my website, thenarrowpath.com, and you'll find the tab that says topical articles. Once you click on that, you'll see there's one called divorce and remarriage, and that's a very lengthy and I think fairly comprehensive treatment of the subject from a biblical viewpoint. Let's talk to Earl from El Cajon, California. Earl, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Good morning, Steve. I was reading 1 Corinthians, the 10th chapter, trying to understand the context of verse 31 that says, whether you eat or drink or whatever you do, do all to the glory of God. And then in reading from verse 1, I read across verse 7 when it says, and do not be idolaters, as some of war, as is written, that people sit down to eat and drink and sit up to play. Can you explain that verse and how it relates to the context of chapter 10?
Yeah, but and we're going to have to see the larger context, because chapter... you want to go off? Okay, that's fine. Thanks, Earl. The context is not merely chapter 10, but chapters 8 through 10. Paul has a discussion for three chapters, beginning in chapter 8 and concluding in chapter 10, where he's discussing a controversy that existed among the early Christians in Corinth, and that was that some were feeling the liberty to go ahead and eat food that was sacrificed to idols, and others felt they should not do that, especially the Jews in the church would not want to do that, and probably some of the Gentiles felt badly about it too, because they had been idolaters and they wanted to separate themselves from that. However, eating meat sacrificed to idols had two different scenarios. One was they had festivals to the pagan gods in the idol temples, where they had feasts and so forth, and some Christians wanted to go in there and eat the food. Others wouldn't do that. And they were even scrupled about eating meat sold in the marketplace, because lots of the meat merchants, whether it was mentioned or labeled or not, were selling remnants of animals that had been sacrificed in the temples to the pagan gods. So the meat you would buy in the regular marketplace, in many cases, had been sacrificed. The animal had been sacrificed to a deity, and so some Christians wouldn't eat that either. Now, Paul is arguing that there's nothing wrong with eating meat. If it was sacrificed to an idol, it's just meat. It's not a big deal. Unless, of course, it offends your brother, in which case you shouldn't do it. You shouldn't stumble your brother. But he did say going into the idol temples and eating and the feast there, that was something that's kind of overstepping the line, and people shouldn't do that. So the question of eating and drinking was being discussed, of eating especially meat sacrificed to idols. Now, he points out in chapter 10 that the Israelites fell under God's judgment because they fell into idolatry as early as the golden calf incident at Mount Sinai. They also did on other occasions. And Paul points out in the opening chapters, the first opening verses, first 11 verses of chapter 10, that the Israelites serve as an example for us, that God judged them for their idolatry, and we need to not fall into that either. And this, of course, is meant as a rebuke to anyone who was perhaps a Christian and perhaps flirting with idolatry, maybe going into those idol temples and participating in those feasts. They need to beware, as the Israelites should have been more wary of the danger of falling into idolatry, because God will judge. However, later in the chapter, he says, whatever you eat or drink, do it all to the glory of God. He's saying, essentially, although all foods are lawful for Christians to eat, some foods, upon eating them, would certainly bring a reproach or an undesired consequence. It might be that your example of eating meat sacrificed to idols would lead a weaker brother to do the same and to be drawn right back into idolatry. And Paul's concerned about that. And he's saying, make sure that when you eat or drink, you're not simply deciding on what your rights are or what your palate would appreciate, you know, but think about the glory of God. Is God going to be glorified? Is his kingdom going to be advanced? Are the interests of God's people going to be served through you eating on this occasion, in this particular place, in this idol temple, for example? And the answer is, of course, not. So when he says that we should do everything, including what we eat or drink, to the glory of God, he's speaking specifically of the choice whether or not to eat meat sacrificed to idols, and especially in any connection that might stumble a brother or lead him into idolatry. And so that's the context of 1 Corinthians 10. All right. Our next caller is Aaron calling from Long Beach, California. Hello, Aaron. Welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Good morning. My question is in regards to dichotomy and trichotomy. I know in the past you had mentioned you kind of take the trichotomy view, and that piqued my interest. I'm wondering what what the Bible says and what you say about what happens in death and with the trichotomous point of view, or even both points of views. I'm thinking, like, does the spirit go up to heaven and the soul is reborn, for a lack of better words, or what exactly would be the difference in those views, I guess?
Well, there are differences of opinion among Christians as to what happens at death, though I'm not sure that a significant difference in that matter exists between the trichotomous and the dichotomous. For those who don't know those fancy words, a dichotomist believes that humans are made up of two parts, the physical and non-physical. And that the non-physical part can be called by many names. It can be called the heart, it can be called the mind, it can be called the soul, it can be called the spirit, but that all of these terms are more or less referring to the same entity, the non-physical part of man. Paul speaks about the outer man is perishing, but the inner man is renewed day by day. He doesn't distinguish within the inner man between different subcategories, but he just talks about there being two different, you know, aspects, the inner man and the outer man. A dichotomist believes that the physical body is, of course, one part of man, and the inner man, the spiritual part, can be the soul, the heart, the mind, the spirit, whatever, the inner man. So they believe that people are made of two parts. Now, a trichotomist, puts a little finer point on it. Says, well, it's true, there are those two aspects of man. There's the physical, and there's the non-physical, but in the non-physical, there's even a further subdivision between soul and spirit. And the trichotomist, therefore, believes there's three parts of man, not just inner man and outer man, but body, soul, and spirit. So a trichotomist believes in three parts, and the dichotomist in two parts. The as far as your question about death, as near as I can tell, a dichotomist would suggest that at death, unless they believe in soul sleep, and of course many people do, but that's not specifically a dichotomist position. But there are people who believe in soul sleep. But apart from those, a dichotomist would assume that the non-material part of man goes to be with God at death, and the physical goes into the grave. A trichotomist would believe exactly the same thing. The physical body goes into the grave, and the non-material part, which is identified as the soul and spirit, the two parts of the non-physical, would go to be with God. Now, this is not the only view of what happens at death that is supported by various Christians, but I don't think the dichotomists and the trichotomists have a significantly different assumption about what happens at death, since both parties believe that man has a physical part that is buried in the ground and decays after death, and a non-physical part, which, on the views of many, goes to be with God at death. And that would be my view also. I lean toward trichotomy, but I'm not adamant about it, because I can see things in the Bible that sometimes do suggest that the spirit and the soul might be used interchangeably in Scripture in some places. On the other hand, there are some places that sound like maybe there's a distinction made between them, as when Paul talks about God sanctifying your bodies and your soul and your spirit. And that's not the order he says it. I think he says spirit, soul, and body. Holy. And I believe that that is a suggestion that Paul believed in a trichotomy, but it's not really a big deal to me. It's very difficult, even for a trichotomist, to clearly distinguish between what the soul and the spirit would be. I have my own opinions, but they don't carry a lot of scriptural weight, and so I wouldn't impose them on you. I don't really consider the trichotomy-dichotomy controversy to be much of a controversy at all, at least not with me. It wouldn't really matter to me if we have two parts or three. And as far as what happens at death, I hold the same picture of what happens at death if I were a dichotomist as I do as a trichotomist. All right. Sounds like maybe our caller's not there anymore. But thank you, Aaron, for your call. Who's been waiting the longest? Looks like Bob from San Francisco has been waiting the longest. Bob, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, my question is,
the last couple of years, I did not show the proper affection to my wife, and intimately, and you know, I took from her quite a bit, and she gave so much to me, and in areas that I didn't. And several months, a month and a half ago, she just said, I've had it, I can't do this anymore. And she's giving me a deadline till next Monday to give me her answer, whether she wants to be with me or she's leaving me. And I just was wondering what your comments on that.
Well, you need, have you repented to her for the ways you've hurt her?
Yeah, and she won't even have contact with me until next week on a certain day she set up. I've been in counseling.
And what's this? Okay. But next week, she's going to give you her answer. She's going to ask you for an answer of some kind. What's exactly going to happen next week? Is she a Christian?
Yes, we both are. And
have you given her grounds for divorce?
No, I wasn't unfaithful, but I didn't give her intimacy for a couple of years of just issues of myself, and I guess you could say I emotionally hurt her by that, and just I made some bad financial decisions, and
well, what I could say about that is that those are very wrong things for a husband to do, as you apparently already know now, And it's very hurtful to a wife, and it certainly puts pressure on her, but they don't rise to the level of grounds for divorce. I could see possibly her, you know, saying, I don't know how serious the problems have been, but I could see her saying, you know, I need to take a break here because I feel like I'm going to just blow up, or I feel like I'm going to go crazy here. I'm gonna step out and stay with a friend for a few weeks or something like that. But and then maybe we can work something out and come back together in a better situation. Divorce is not really an option for her in this case, I don't believe. Some people believe that some people believe you can divorce for somebody's failure to have sexual intercourse in marriage. There was a law in the Old Testament that talked about a man, if he took a second wife, which was permitted in Old Testament times, that he should not deny his earlier wife of money, that is support, or sexual privileges. And if he did deny her, she could go free and be, you know, loosed from that. So the Jews held that for, you know, if a person did not have, you know, proper sexual involvement with their spouse, that if they refused to, that this was something that could be grounds for divorce. But I don't think that Jesus said that. I mean, Jesus certainly didn't say that. I don't know that he believed it either. So I would, if I were in her position, frankly, I was in her position. I was in a marriage years ago where my wife was, you know, this back when I was in my early 20s, 40 years ago, that my wife would not have any physical intimacy with me either for a couple of years. I wouldn't divorce her. It was very difficult marriage, probably more difficult for a man than for a woman in that case. But and I wouldn't cheat on her either. I didn't cheat, and I wouldn't leave her. And she finally left and took off with someone else. But in other words, if I say she doesn't have grounds for divorce, I'm not putting a burden on her that I didn't bear myself or wouldn't. I would have stayed with her to this day if she hadn't left, because I don't believe in divorce. I'm a Christian. And so anyway, I think that if she's getting Christian counsel, that will counsel her not to divorce you. If they're not Christians.
Well, I mean, yeah, she isn't. They have all told her, like, this isn't, and be careful of your actions, but she said she just fell out of love for me, and she has shut it down, so, and I can't.
Well, falling out of love with someone is not grounds for divorce either. In fact, falling out of love with someone isn't necessarily permanent. So, a person who gives up their marriage for that is not.
I know now what happened when she brought this to me, and I'm trying to do everything I can for myself, whether she says yes or no, for my issues I've had, but also for us to be a stronger marriage. But it's just really hard right now. And if you could just keep me in prayer.
Yeah, well, I'm sure it is very hard, and I'm sure our listeners will be praying for you and for your wife. I'm sure there's many listeners out there who probably have more sympathy for your wife than for you in this situation, because it sounds like you are the wrongdoer. But whether sympathetic towards your wife or not, and I'm sympathetic towards your wife, but I don't believe she has grounds for divorce. I think that as a Christian, we all have to keep our vows, and we all have to work at it. We can't just say, well, I'm done. I mean, well, some people do, you know, but there are Christians who have been tortured to death. There have been Christians who have been tortured to death without saying, I'm done. That is, they've remained faithful to their following Christ, even through torture and even to martyrdom. We are a little more wimpy nowadays. We'll give up on Christ. Because when you give up on your marriage in a situation where Christ says you can't, then you're giving up on Christ too, because he's not your Lord. If you're saying, I know, Jesus, that you're telling me to stay in this marriage, but I don't care what you say, I'm going to do what I want. That's renouncing the lordship of Christ, I believe. And some people say, whoa, don't we all sin? Don't we all do that? We do, but we repent. You see, when a person has contemplated divorce and goes through with it, and they're violating the commands of Christ, and they stay away, they are living in sin. That's different. Every Christian sins, but every Christian who sins repents. A person who leaves their spouse against the will of God and does not go back is living in sin. They're not repenting. And basically they're saying, I really want something more than I want Jesus in my life. I want my relief from this troubled marriage. I want my happiness. I want, you know, to be vindicated. I want to go on and find something better, more than I want to be obedient to Jesus. Now, of course, many preachers will disagree with me on this, and let them disagree. When we stand before God, we'll see what he says, because Jesus spoke very plainly about this. A person who renounces their obedience to Jesus Christ, and that's what you do when you divorce without grounds. When Jesus said, don't divorce, and you do it anyway, then you're basically saying, I'm not going to obey Jesus. He's not my Lord. Well, that's renouncing your salvation, too, as far as I'm concerned. So a person ought to think twice or three or ten times before they ever go that far. And I say that as one who went through a very, very difficult marriage. But, you know, I take God seriously. And that's, of course, all true Christians do. When someone says, I'm a little more interested in my happiness than in taking God that seriously, well, they're not really ready to be saved yet. They're not really ready to be a Christian yet. Jesus has to be your Lord. If he's not your Lord, he's not your Savior. That's what the Bible teaches. Well, I guess I made a lot of people mad in these last 30 seconds. But, yeah, that happens sometimes. You've been listening to The Narrow Path. My name is Steve Gregg. We are listener-supported. If you'd like to help us out, you can go to our website, thenarrowpath.com. And there you can find the address. If you want to send us a check or if you want to donate online, you can do that. But we do pay for the radio time we use. And it is by donations from people like you that we stay on the air. If you'd like to help us out again, it's thenarrowpath.com. And we'll talk again tomorrow. God bless you.
The views and opinions expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of KBRT, its ownership, its management, or its sponsors.
Thanks for taking time out of your day to join us here on KBRT for The Narrow Path with Steve Gregg. And when you hear Steve talk about the teaching that he has available on thenarrowpath.com, if you want to see what's there, make sure you set aside quite a bit of time. There's a ton of material. I think the count's upwards of 900 lectures, studies, debates, topical explorations of key biblical doctrine. Steve's been busy for the last few decades. Best of all, everything is free. He doesn't sell anything on the site or even push for a donation. It's just free. Definitely take advantage of all that's there. Now, that's thenarrowpath.com, but I do have to add, it does cost Steve a lot to be on the air for the Narrow Path program, and that's where you can help. Please pray about an amount you could give each month for 6 months. That would help the Narrow Path get fully listener-supported, which is the only way he can stay on KBRT for the long term. You can get on board with that at thenarrowpath.com.
KBRT and KBRT HD Costa Mesa and KNSN San Diego, serving all counties in all of Southern California and on the web at KBRT740.com.
Welcome to Enjoying Everyday Life with New York Times bestselling author Joyce Meyer. On today's program, Joyce will be teaching from her series entitled The Fruit of the Spirit. Do you seek God on a daily basis and ask Him to help you be a better person? Yet sometimes it feels like you have not grown at all? That can be frustrating, but know that as a Christian, God has blessed you with spiritual fruit to help you be that better person. It's just that life can sometimes hinder that growth. Know that the deeper you go with God, the more that fruit will grow. So stay tuned as Joyce helps explain what the fruit of the Spirit is and what it means to you. But before she begins, we want to continue to give you the opportunity to show the love of Christ with those who might feel forgotten. To find out what you can do, visit our website at joycemeyer.org/Christmas. Now, here's Joyce with today's teaching, The Fruit of the Spirit.
I remember one time, this was a long time ago, I was teaching a little weekly meeting in St. Louis, and it was long before I went on TV and started to travel like I do now. And we had a blind couple that came to our meeting every week, and they took public transportation to get there, and something happened to the bus service in the area where they were, and they weren't going to be able to get to the weekly Bible study anymore on a bus. And they asked if I could find somebody that would pick them up and bring them and take them back. And do you know, they had to stop coming because nobody wanted to go out of their way. Now, how sad is that? Now, obviously, everybody's not like that. There's a lot of wonderful people that do things for people all the time. But there's not enough of us. And we need to learn what love really is, and that it's more than just a song we sing and something we talk about.